Welcome to the Your Oxygen Mask First podcast. I'm Erin Young, and this is a space where we explore ways to help the helpers. Because you can't help anyone before you help yourself. So sit back, put your own oxygen mask on, and enjoy the ride. Thanks again for joining us, and I'm thrilled to introduce you to Kathy and Chad Robichaux. Kathy is a co-founder and partner relations for Mighty Oaks and a mother of three beautiful children. Her husband, Chad, is the founder and president of Mighty Oaks. Chad is also a United States Marine Corps Force Recon veteran, a best-selling author, and a pro MMA champion. Chad tells a little bit of his story on their website about being in the U.S. Marine Corps and how he was compelled to go back after 9/11. They've had a very tough transition time that hit them both personally and their family pretty hard. They have an important and beautiful story about how they hit a very low point, how Kathy connected deeply with her faith in God, and onto the journey of healing and reconciliation. I appreciate the vulnerability and the rawness of how they've told their story so that others may have hope. And at the top of their website, it says, saving lives, restoring families, and changing legacies. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. Mm-hmm.
So Kathy, we'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, like you said, I'm a mother of three. The best gift that God has ever given me are my three children. And Chad and I have been married for 23 years. We got married, well, I was just right out of high school. And Chad was going on his second year in the Marine Corps. And so here we are after, almost a marriage falling apart. We were able to come through on the other side with the grace of God, helping it and restoring our marriage. And today, now we get to be part of an amazing foundation that founded back in 2011 called Mighty Oaks Foundation. And that's where we're at today.
And what about you, Chad?
Kathy is, being married 23 years, that's the majority of my life. We got married when I was 20 years old, or 19 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the majority of my life has been with Kathy, but I grew up as a son of a Marine Corps veteran, and now my son Hunter, who's deploying tomorrow to Afghanistan, is a third-generation Marine. So Marine Corps has been a big part of my life and family. Marine Corps for me, having grown up in a kind of very dysfunctional home, a recipient of the PTSD from the aspect of being a child of a father who struggled with that. I went in the Marine Corps for a brand new chance in life, and really, truly loved my time in the Marine Corps, loved the job I got to do as a Force Reconnaissance Marine, and had the opportunity to serve as part of a Joint Special Operations Command Task Force in Afghanistan for 8 rotation. Part of that, story that you talked about was the coming home from that and the facing the hardships that of many of our veterans face, being diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, facing a battle with trying to decide if I want to live or die, and struggled with taking my own life, and then facing a very nasty divorce between Kathy and I. And on the other side of that, found this restoration in our family. We found hope, and we found a purpose moving forward, and that was to pay forward what we had been given, that mentorship, that guidance, that people that would come alongside of us and love us and carry us through that situation, and in the grace of God, move forward. And then we started Mighty Oaks Foundation, and since 2011, our lives has been 100% committed to that cause and helping other veterans just like us.
Wow, that's incredible. And thank you for your service. I'm sure you hear that a lot, but we truly do mean it. I mean it. After speaking to a couple of veterans on the show, we had talked to Jeremy from the Mighty Oaks Foundation a little while ago in September, and he and his information was amazing, but it's really given me an opportunity to learn more about the reality of being a veteran and the family and what you guys go through together as a unit. So I appreciate Kathy and all you've been through as well, being by his side.
Yeah, a lot of people say that, and I don't know, I usually don't know what to say to that when they say it, because it was kind of, for me, just something I just had to do. I had no choice. When my husband made that choice to fight for our country, I supported him and went along with it, and And actually, to tell you the truth, I just told somebody the other day, I said, when my husband would deploy, you just figure it out. You have kids to raise, you have a home to take care of, and your day by day just has to get done. Where now I have a son about to leave, and it's a whole lot different. It's something just, something hits a little bit harder when your own child is about to leave.
So that kind of dovetails into my next topic for discussion, Kathy. We'll start with you. What was it like being a wife of a recon?
Well, my situation is a little different. When Chad was first in the Marine Corps active duty, this was before anything was really going on. So I got to see my husband do some really cool things. He was a stud, you know. I'm just meeting him for the first time as a young girl in high school, and so get married, and he's out in the field doing, you know, all the recon training. And then in 97, it was time for him to make the choice whether he was going to reenlist or get out. And he decided to go ahead and get out. He went into law enforcement, and we moved to Louisiana, actually, where he's originally from. And he started with his law enforcement career and continued to stay in the reserves with the Marine Corps as a recon Marine. He did some crazy things. Of course, every time he, as a reserve, they were always doing, probably going skydiving or whatever the crazy things they do. I'd hear that. So that was just kind of part of life. But it wasn't until after 9/11 that he decided to go back in. And that was a whole new world for us, because now we are in a serious situation, going to war. And that was really scary, knowing that he was doing some things out there that were definitely dangerous. And you don't know what's going to happen. And thankfully, I didn't really watch too much news. And this was, you know, early 2004, 2005. And I was very busy with the kids. So I didn't really, I wasn't, Chad will explain more, but because of his type of unit, he was, I didn't live on base. So I kind of was shielded against, I guess, the fear of that could possibly take place when your husband's away or your spouse is away. But for me, I had that at the back of my head, but I had this motivation and determination to keep moving forward, to keep my kids, you know, feed my kids, keep my kids alive, and just get them off to school and try to figure out daily life with being somewhat of a single mom. I mean, thankfully, I had the support from a husband who provides for us, but doing everything on my own. And at that time, we no longer lived by any family. So raising three kids on my own, I had to be mom, I had to be dad, I had to be plumber and so many things. And that was pretty tough at the time. But I did it, and that was just what life was like for me.
And Chad, why don't you tell us a little bit about your time as a U.S. Marine, and how was it being a married man away from your family so far away?
I mean, you know, I always wanted to be a Marine because my father was a Marine, and like I said, I, you know, grew up, you know, really dysfunctional home. There was a lot of physical abuse in our home. And if anybody's ever listening, ever grown up at home like that, you know that the siblings get very close to one another. And so I had an older brother, a year older than me, and we talk about joining the military to really just escape that life and get a fresh start at life. When I was and so we started training together when I was like 13 years old. We started running and swimming and, you know, pretending to be in, you know, some type of special operations. And when I was 14 and he was 15, he was shot and killed. So it was really tragic for me, and I really went in a deep isolation. But I just really focused on pursuing that goal. And so my life as a teenage kid was just really kind of very disciplined and very laser-focused on that. And when I was 17 years old, I was able to join the Marine Corps without a high school diploma because of my really situation that I was in. And so I always looked at the Marine Corps as that really second chance at life for me. And very much appreciated it. And that first year in the Marine Corps, I got a chance to try out to be a reconnaissance Marine, and and made it through the initial training. And, you know, making it through the initial training is one thing, but then you continue on more and more advanced training over the years. And so it's just a job that I always really appreciated. And it's, I couldn't have, even throughout my life, even looking back now, I couldn't imagine I've done anything else. I worked with, you know, people that wanted to be at their job and desired to do that job and pushed each other. And it was like a true, really brotherhood for me growing up without that sense of family, to have being such a closely knitted and bonded unit like that. It just was something I really just valued. And then, you know, Kathy came along. And I remember when Kathy and I first got married, most of the guys in our unit were single. So our house and base housing was like the kind of clubhouse. The guys would come over and we'd have, you know, 15, 20 guys in our house, and just, you know, brand newly couple. And it was kind of the hangout place. And so we just were all very close. But when 9/11 did happen and I tried out for this JSOC task force, the job of the traditional job of being a recon Marine and deploying in that capacity was a little bit different. My job was a little bit different in the sense that I used a lot of my reconnaissance training, but worked in a capacity of doing clandestine logistics for a special operations command that we were supporting, and which meant that, you know, I didn't live on bases. I lived out in the community with local Afghans, the local Afghan people, and worked in plain clothes and not very much of support. So it was a very unique way to work. It really created a further separation for me and Kathy, because I had to be very vague on phone conversations and emails, and she was aware of this. And it just wasn't a lot of information to be relayed to her. So it was a very big, when I would deploy, it was a very big distance between us. Kathy just handled that so well. I never called home and she was complaining about the washing machine being broken or burdened me with the things that were going on at home. She really did her service well as a military spouse to allow me to be able to do my job. And I think she's, you know, I think looking back, I think she really seen it that way and allowed me to focus on my job in Afghanistan. And so I think that was a part that, looking back now, I really appreciate it, because, you know, what I did, the type of work we did there was so demanding, and I couldn't imagine having to bring in the pressures of family life into that mix.
Wow, that's incredible. You had to spend so much time and not be able to really connect with the person that you love. But it sounds like you guys handled it and were able to at least keep that connection through those times. So tell me a little bit, and I'm not sure who wants to speak to this first, but what happened when Chad separated from the military and what changed things?
Yeah, our separation from the military was a lot different than probably most people's. Probably about halfway through, you know, my time of deploying, you know, almost a period of 4 years, these problems started to surface. It initially started as me being just very angry, very intense, which actually that anger intensity worked really well doing my job. And I shared that mentality and behaviors with everyone I worked with, all the guys on my task force, the command we were attached to, and even the Afghans we worked with. You know, they hated the Taliban, and so it was very angry, aggressive, almost like Viking type mindset that was taking place. And while that worked in Afghanistan, it didn't work at home. I mean, I'd come home and I'd be just angry and carrying that behaviors, and, you know, Kathy and the kids were, you know, they were scared of me because it was just so intense, and everyone's walking on eggshells, worried about, you know, setting me off like a time bomb. Eventually, the anger started turning into this anxiety, these physiological symptoms. My arms would go numb, my face would go numb. Sometimes I feel like my throat was swelling shut. And I knew this was stress, but I didn't really want to admit it, and I certainly wasn't going to ask for help. So I started trying to just push that down. And eventually, it really surfaced and manifested the way that I was even forgetting things, having these blackout periods. And I finally had to say something, and I was brought home, and I was diagnosed with PTSD, and it was something very serious we had to face. But prior to that moment, I had switched to having a direct contract to my command, so I went from being an active duty Marine to a DOD contractor in my command. And so because of that, my process out wasn't like I go to Wounded Warrior Battalion, and I get processed through a medical treatment plan. It was overnight, and it was like the rug was pulled out from underneath us. And I had to figure out what I was going to do next. There was treatment available for me, I was able to see a psychologist, and the command was really taking care of me in that sense. But what I was going to do for a living moving forward, to not to be able to do that job anymore, this job that I thought was the most important job in the world, and which I thought, you know, for me, I thought that's what I was born for. And it stung my pride. I was ashamed because I felt like I failed. And I was also scared because I felt like my body was physiologically going to just die at any moment. I mean, if anybody's ever experienced panic attacks before, you know, it's so overwhelming. You feel like your body's just going to shut down. And so that's where I was. So the transition was very quick for us, and we had to figure out what we were going to do next. We weren't prepared for that.
And what about you, Kathy?
So for me, the transition was, it was a rude awakening. I don't know how else to describe it. That I saw this, you know, warrior of a man for such a long time. I never seen Chad in a place where he felt vulnerable, where he felt weak, where he felt scared. Maybe he did have that. I just never experienced that. I thought he was the most confident man in the world and strongest man in the world. And so when he came home, I saw such a different person. And for me, it was a quiet spirit that I saw in Chad. I don't know how else to describe that other than he was just, yeah, broken in a way, like kind of like a child almost cries out for comfort from his mom or his dad. It was like that. And for me, the mother in me, the nurturer in me, wanted to comfort him, wanted to love him through this, wanted to pray for him, wanted to, we would sit in the backyard for hours and just play rummy cards, something that was quiet, but yet just to be there with him. And to tell you the truth, that was the easiest part of the whole process. I didn't know it at the time until 3 years later when my marriage would fall apart, because not long after that quietness and that cry stopped, the anger came. But I had no clue what post-traumatic stress was. Like I said, we didn't live on a base. We didn't have that education, awareness. We just knew that it was out there, and this is what he was diagnosed with. And so I didn't look into getting educated on what post-traumatic stress is. I just dealt with him being who he was, being this angry man, being this unloving person. And I have to say, though, there was a lot of things in our marriage that had already hurt me through the years that I just thought this was just, you know, coming to a point where this is just all adding up. He doesn't, maybe in a way, he doesn't want to be in our marriage anymore. He's not happy. That's how I looked at it. I thought maybe something was wrong with me, and I wasn't even looking at anything that had to do with post-traumatic stress. In fact, I do say a lot of times, because when we work with the women that come through our program, women of spouse or the spouses of veterans, they will express in a similar way how I express it. And it reminds me how I used to say, you were a jerk before you came home. You were a jerk before you were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress. So how can I relate this now? And this is just okay, this is your past. You got post-traumatic stress. So everything's good. We can move forward and you can act like that. I don't know. It was so hard to be able to want to understand what he was going through and to even be gracious in that time. So for me, in that transition, it was easy at the beginning, the first 3 months, but the following almost 3 years was so hard. And I got to a point where I thought, if I can make it till my kids graduate high school, I'm out of here. And that was my way of thinking at the time, because who I was married to was not any fun, and I did not know how to deal with it at that time.
So what happened when you did hit that low point, that crisis point? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Me or Chad?
We'll start with Chad first.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was what I was. My lowest point wasn't coming home from Afghanistan. My lowest point was the aftermath of that. You know, when I came home, I was in this very dark place. I was just like Kathy said. I was just broken. I was ashamed and I was scared, and I needed something to help me climb out of that hole that I found myself in. And Kathy, my counselor, the psychologist, recommended that I do jiu-jitsu. Because I'd done it my whole life. I was already a professional fighter. I was doing it on the side in the military. And so something I was successful at, and again, I did it since I was 5 years old. I was initially worried about doing anything physical because I thought my heart was going to stop. That's the way I felt physiologically. But they convinced me I'd be fine. And so I got on those mats and I started doing jiu-jitsu. And literally, I felt like I found the cure. And so I just dove into this sport. And in jiu-jitsu, I believe it's something good for you. I believe it was good for me at the time, and it is still to this day. I still do it, and I'll probably do it my whole life. But instead of taking this thing that could be good for me, like, you know, if you were sick, you'd take a medicine to get well, but you could also abuse that medicine. And that's really what I did with jiu-jitsu. I instead of getting well, I found it as a place to hide, like climbing in a bottle of alcohol. I would take every fight I could. And I would just really invest in myself and spend every hour I could on those mats, and I became very successful. Our school almost reached the limit of 1,000 students, and I was fighting on television and pay-per-view and Showtime, and I won a world title belt, and at one time I was, you know, very long stint to be undefeated. I ended up retiring at 18-2 as a professional fighter. So I had all this success on the surface, but I wasn't getting better. My anger was still there. My anxiety was still there. I was still having panic attacks at night. I just had this outlet that was like a temporary band-aid for it. And so eventually, the walls would come crashing down, and our marriage just continued to deteriorate. Our home still was falling apart. And didn't take long for me to walk outside of our marriage and relationships with women and an affair, and to sit our family down and to make a decision where we get divorced. And that, you know, I remember telling our kids that everything was going to be better because we wouldn't have to go to fighting anymore. And our kids were devastated. And we sold our home. And Kathy and I got two separate apartments, 12-month leases on apartments. And we were, you know, Kathy filed the paperwork for the divorce. And so this began the lowest point of my life. At first, I thought this is what I wanted. You know, I wouldn't have to deal with Kathy anymore because I blamed everyone else for everything, and, you know, Kathy was on a list of people I blamed because she didn't understand what I went through, and she didn't know how to deal with me, so she was, like, at fault. And so I found myself in this apartment alone and facing the damage that I had created, the hurt to Kathy and our children, and really coming to the point of accepting responsibility for that. And the acceptance of responsibility that came over me wasn't like, hey, I need to fix this. It was, I'm the problem. And so if I could eliminate myself from the situation, you know, my family would be sad, but they'll be better off. And so I thought, you know, yeah, of course they're going to be sad if I'm gone, but they're going to be better off. And so I made a decision that I was going to take my life. And I would sit in my closet with my pistol, and I had family pictures. I'll keep my family pictures in my closet. And I'd look at them and try to decide, you know, how I was going to do this. And one of the things that kept me from actually pulling the trigger was the fact that I knew my kids would be the ones that would find me, because they were the ones. Hunter, my oldest son, had a key to my apartment, and they could walk in any time, and I knew they were really the only people coming to visit me. So I knew they would find me. So that's what delayed me. And it was, it was Kathy that unwittingly saved me and intervened. And, you know, she came to my apartment and she knocked on the door, and I remember answering it, and we got in an argument, and she asked me a question that it radically changed my life, and it's the reason we're on this conversation right now. She asked me how I could do everything I did in the Marine Corps. You know, she seen me do all these things to become a recon Marine and train for these deployments and do this job that we were doing in Afghanistan. And then she seen me train for these fights and cut weight and train so hard to win these fights. And, the, you know, she just seen a life of discipline. And so I think what she was asking me was, you know, how could you do all of that, all those things, and when it comes to your family, you'll quit? And that question for me, it just radically impacted me. She said it before, but in that moment, for me, I heard it loud and clear, and I knew I quit on the most important thing in my life, being a husband, being a father, being that young 17-year-old kid that joined the Marine Corps, like so excited to have a second chance at life and had embraced that at one moment. And then I even quit on my own will to live and my own health. And so I just, in that moment, at that rock bottom, I had made a decision that I was going to turn things around. I have one of the friends that came through Mighty Oaks, he says, rock bottom turns out to be a pretty good place to rebuild from. That's where I was. It was more lower for me to go. And when Kathy asked me that question, I knew that it was time for me to, you know, pull things back together and get back in the fight for the most important things in my life. And I'm a pretty radical decision maker. And so it was a complete 180 in that one moment for me.
Oh, wow. And Kathy, that must have been such a hard part for you to stand there in his apartment and say those words. How did you do it?
It never gets easier to talk about. Well, at that time, being apart like that and knowing that, actually having to let my children at the time, who were all pretty young, I think the youngest one, Hayden, was in fifth grade, and Haley and Hunter would have been in, or maybe Hayden was in fourth grade, and Hunter and Haley were in sixth grade or so, sixth or seventh grade, and, you know, and being with your kids every day of their life, your husband making the choice to leave the marriage and leave our family, it killed me that I had to give up my children and not be with them. And so for me, the pain was so, obviously you can see the pain was so unbearable that I just got on my knees and just started praying, and I already had my faith in the Lord, but at this time, it just grew so much stronger and closer because I didn't have anyone else to go to, and definitely no one to comfort me the way I needed comfort. And so I picked up a book called Power of a Praying Wife because I really felt God putting it on my heart to pray for my husband. And at the time, I decided to do that mainly because I didn't want my kids to see a hatred for my husband and me for what he had been choosing to do. I grew up in a divorced home, and I saw that hatred with my parents, and I saw bitterness and unforgiveness that actually never took place. And my mom has already passed away, and I never saw any peace in any of them from their marriage and from their divorce. And so I just didn't want that for my kids. And so between that and God, you know, really putting it on my heart to pray for my husband, I thought, well, how do you even pray for somebody you don't even like? Mm. So the book Power of a Praying Wife by Stormy Orr Martin, I believe is how you say her last name. I picked that up thinking, okay, this will help me. Just some great guidance on how to pray for your husband. She also has other books, which I use now, Power of Praying Parents, and now Power of Praying for Your Adult Children. Just some great books to help guide me personally in prayer time. I thought, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to just start praying for everything he's doing wrong. So I went through the table of contents, and I thought his integrity, his choices, just everything that he was doing wrong. But the very first prayer in there is praying for his wife. And so I thought he should be praying for me, not me praying for me. But I did. I'd read through it, and then God started, this took place over time, but God started opening my heart to seeing a lot of my own faults and my own actions that led up to this separation, and actually gave me a reason to find healing in forgiving him. And so that's where I was at the time that I went to his apartment, and I was just, I was sad. I knew something was wrong with him. It took a while to get there because for a while we were separated, I knew what he was really out there doing, and the choices he was making was definitely not anything to bring us closer or to reconcile our marriage. But at this time that I went to his apartment, I think he was having a major meltdown because he got the divorce papers from me and saw that enough was enough. I think he really did want his cake and eat it too, maybe still at that time. And I think with seeing those divorce papers that I can't keep being here for you when you're not faithful to me, our children. And he was lying to our children of what was really happening. And so it was just so painful. And so when it all came down to it, and I asked him those questions, when I don't understand how you do all of these things, the determination, no, quitting is not even an answer. And his or any, nor have I met a single recon Marine or Navy SEAL that know that failure is an option. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to our family, you quit. And it was a short time later that I got a phone call from him, and it basically said, I don't want to lose the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I'm thinking, wow, this hurts so bad. Like, my kids are hurting. We sold our beautiful home that we put so much into for the first time because we were married young. We're finally in a place that we had a beautiful home, and something as, you know, putting in the pool just was huge for me, for us to be able to do that for our family and our children. We did all this stuff and had to give it all up so you can do your thing, and now you're ready to come home. And so I didn't know what to do at that moment, because the hardest part was actually getting out of that situation and saying enough is enough and not being treated like that anymore. And so I decided to ask somebody in my church for some help. I called my church. I said, is there somebody I can talk to? I really wanted somebody that would give me biblical advice, but somebody that really didn't have a lot of insight, a lot of the hatred that, or has heard the hatred in me, or the frustration in me, or heard everything that Chad has done wrong. I just wanted somebody that would have a clean slate, give me biblical advice of how I should move forward. And that was the day I got a phone call back from an elder on staff. His name was Steve Toth. He said, hey, I'm an elder on staff. I can meet you at Starbucks in an hour. And so we met in a public place, obviously being a female and a male, and he gave me a few minutes to speak. It was so funny. Here I am ready to just lay everything out. And he kind of just real quick got me from A to B in a short period of time. I felt like I like still needed to cry and get it all out before he was done with me. But he didn't say, go take your husband back, but he did say, would your husband be willing to speak to me or somebody from the church? And I said, oh, no, he's not going to talk to anybody unless he's a special forces guy. I don't think my husband's going to talk to anybody. And Steve was like, perfect. I got the perfect person for him. We actually have a retired Navy SEAL who's an elder on staff. And I thought, oh, praise God, my husband's going to be saved. You know, my marriage is going to be restored. Or I guess that's kind of in a way what I was thinking or hoping for. But the crazy thing is my husband ended up connecting with Steve Toth. And that's the man. He was a small business owner at the time, now a state legislator for the state of Texas. Just somebody completely different than who I would have ever thought he'd speak to. And they connected, and this man ended up introducing him into a relationship with Jesus Christ, which led to learning how to be a man of God, a husband who, maybe it's not always easy to love your wife, but learns how to love your wife in the hard times. And then, which also turned into a mentorship of how to restore his marriage, our marriage. And this man was the first one that he really listened to that actually put him in his place. No one ever told Chad anything he needed to hear. It was always everything that lifted him up, what he wanted to hear. People praised him, but no one would ever say what he was doing wrong and actually challenged him on it. And this was the first guy, and Chad would go back to him. She's not accepting my apology. She's not accepting that I love her. She's not accepting me. And Steve would just remind him, did you give her a reason to be like that? What did you, you know, just would bring up stuff to him, bring up reasons that had hurt me. And and Chad was able to recognize, yes, you're right. This is what I did. And this is what I need to do to move forward, to fix this. And so it didn't happen overnight. It was a very long process. I don't know what was harder, the process of going through it or the process of restoring the marriage, of coming through on the other side, because it's so hard. It's so hard to forget the past. But I would say for the first time in all the times that he had hurt me, I was definitely willing to forgive this time, and that was with the help of God to get through that with him, to learn how to forgive Chad. But the forgetting it is another thing, and trying to let that past go. But there's been times that I just sit here and I'll remember something, or we're in the process of doing the script writing for a movie that's going to be made about our story. And a lot of things had came up, and I thought to myself, wow, I can't believe this memory that I just remembered was something that used to just haunt me all day long. And now I just realized I forgot about that. I can't believe that memory's gone. And it just puts me in such a humble position to just praise God for the fact that he can take away those horrible thoughts and not allow them to just torture us day after day anymore. So, but the only way I get to that point is just completely surrendering those thoughts. If I allow those thoughts to grow, which I'm not always great at not letting them grow, but if I just surrender them and just take those thoughts captive, I'm able to move forward in forgiveness or just more joy than what I was able to do in the past.
And I want to take a moment here to tell both of you, thank you so much for being so open and honest and authentic about your story. I know it's terribly difficult to not only tell your truth of your past and what had happened, but then also to hear the other side too and receive that information. So I'm sure you guys have done a lot of telling of your story. It sounds like you've got a script in the work, which is amazing. So you're pretty familiar with it, but still it takes a lot of bravery to come on here and sit with each other and to talk about what happened. And now that you're in a good place, you can do that. So now that you guys have reconciled and are, I'm sure working on a marriage is a continuous process. It will never be a finished product because you're always growing, you're always learning, you're always learning how to better each other as well as yourselves. So what should spouses know when they're in a critical situation and a critical point at their marriage? Let's talk about that.
I think one of the most important things is, you know, everyone, I think we all do this, we try to do things alone. Even worse than that, than doing it alone, is doing it with the wrong people. So I think that's what we tend to help people who are on the bad side of things at Mighty Oaks. We look at their situation. Either they were trying to do it alone, or they were trying to get the wrong people involved. And so I think, you know, in a marriage, it's very important to have a relationship with someone that's discipling you and leading you. So, you know, for us, Kathy and I, when we stepped out of the situation we were in and stepped in the path to move forward, we did so with Stephen Babateau, who not only became somewhat of mentors and biblical counselors towards us, but also like a marker in which to align our marriage too. And, you know, Kathy and I both came from very broken families. The default answer for a hardship would have been divorce on both sides of our families. And that's what was modeled for us. And so now, you know, us coming to this point to decide we want to do something different than that, you know, what do we align to? What's our marker? And we didn't really, I never thought about that before. We're never intentional about that. And so look at Stephen Babette and say, well, that's what I want our marriage to look like. You know, they live a very biblical marriage, the covenant marriage that God created us and intended us to live. And so to be able to just say, that's the marriage I want to align my life to, and be intentional about that for us was a game changer. To actually put a, you know, if anytime you go on a journey, if you're going to just wander, you're never going to end up there. But if you could put a marker and say, this is where I want to end up and aim for that, and then be intentional about going that direction, you're going to be successful. And for us, that was the key.
And anything you'd like to add, Kathy?
I think he got it. I think that was good.
It's kind of a long answer, but
yeah.
Is there anything specific for that transition out period, or is it pretty much the same?
I think one of your questions was, you asked about, you know, any advice for someone going into military, kids joining the military, as a parent. I mean, I look at my journey and I look at my son Hunter, and there's a very big contrast. Of course, I'm a parent of someone who's been very exposed to the hardships of combat. I've been to Afghanistan 8 times. I run a ministry that helps people whose lives have been broken and turned upside down because of combat. I'm very aware of the risk, physically, mentally, spiritually, that can come from combat. My son's leaving tomorrow for the same place I came from, Afghanistan. That is hard. But the peace that I have comes in knowing that he's prepared. And knowing he's prepared is a three-pillar system that the Marine Corps kind of and other branches of service carry as a, you know, mind, body, and spirit. I know the Marine Corps prepared him mentally for his job. He's extremely motivated. He knows his job well. I know the Marine Corps prepared him physically for his job. As a parent, the one thing that role I could play is I could prepare him spiritually for that job. And I truly believe, because of looking at my life and looking at others who were prepared spiritually, there's a vast difference in how people will come home from combat, seeing and doing things that we were never created or intended to see. We have to do them for the sake of freedom and for the preservation of, you know, mankind and the world. We have to do hard things, but we were never created, intended to see and do these things. And if you're spiritually prepared for those things, yeah, you may have a hard time on the other side, but you're going to bounce back. And I've seen it over and over again. That's why, one of our efforts at Mighty Oaks isn't just the recovery side and the restoration side, it's the resiliency side. And there's nothing I love more than, and I've got to do it every 3 months, every quarter. I go to Marine Corps boot camp. I'm going next weekend. I've been doing it for 3 years now. I go speak to these recruits at Marine Corps boot camp and tell them about spiritual resiliency, what it means to be spiritually strong, to do this job as a warrior, and how it's going to preserve you to be more combat effective, more combat efficient Marine, more ready Marine, but how you can both come back and reintegrate on the other side. For me as a parent, I have a big piece in my heart, knowing that my son's going, they're spiritually prepared. If, you know, God forbid something would happen to him and he would lose his life there, I know his eternity is secure. But more likely, God willing, he's going to come home. He's going to come home safe. And maybe he's going to have seen some things that is going to affect him. But I'm confident he's going to be able to bounce back from those things and recalibrate, because he knows what to recalibrate too, because he's so spiritually strong. And I'm thankful that, you know, Kathy and I have gotten to invest in him that way. And so that's my biggest thing for speaking to anyone that's looking at going in the military or is in the military and looking at having to deploy or sustain life in the military, or, you know, people thinking of parents, that spiritual strength is such an important aspect. And I'm not the only one that believes that. I mean, obviously we do it at Mighty Oaks, but I mean, this is the Commandant of the Marine Corps 2 years ago launched a spiritual fitness plan because they realized the importance of spiritual strength in our warriors. And we get to go to all four branches, and, you know, I think we've spoken to over 100,000 warriors, active duty warriors, on this topic now, and it makes a difference.
Oh, wow, that's absolutely incredible. And your son's lucky, too, now that when he'll come home, he'll have you to come home to, and you can help him gently transition back into civilian life. You're there to guide him.
Yeah, and even while he's gone, you know, we're going to be, I mean, we'll be able to, you know, be there at a distance, but, you know, to be able to encourage him and remind him of, you know, who he is and, you know, where his identity lies. That, you know, being in the military is a very important job, but it is a job, and your identity doesn't fall there. Your identity is, you know, in who you're created to be and what it looks like from a creation standpoint. And I think oftentimes military folks get in trouble when identity becomes their job. You want to really dissect the falling apart of my life. Being a recon marine, being on that task force, that was my identity. There was nothing more important to me in the world at the time. There was nothing separate. That was my focus was on that. And so in a moment when that was taken away from me, I felt like I lost everything. Mm-hmm. I lost my identity. I lost my worth. I lost my value. I lost my purpose. And when you lose something that you hang on to so quickly, you know, it's going to be a major blow, and it's going to be a very bad aftermath. If your identity isn't tied into that, it doesn't take away your ability to do your job well. You could do that job just as good and just as proficient without tying your identity to it. In fact, I believe you could do it better. And that's a very important message for a lot of our young warriors that we attempt to communicate on our resiliency side of Mighty Oaks.
So speaking of Mighty Oaks, the foundation seems like it's a labor of love. What is your vision, hope, and dreams for our veterans, and what role does the Mighty Oaks Foundation play in it?
Well, for me, I believe, you know, a lot of there's 40-plus thousand veterans nonprofits in America. There's a lot of them. Most of them are very well-intended, but a lot of them are awareness organizations. They bring awareness to a problem. And there is a big problem out there. There's 20 plus suicides a day, every day, in our veterans. There's about 30% of people actually claiming and have been diagnosed with PTSD. I believe the number is probably higher, but there's people that would actually be outward hand raisers of post-traumatic stress and combat trauma. And on bases like Camp Pelham, we have an 80% divorce rate in the combat veterans. There's a lot of real, very real problems out there. And many organizations focus around bringing awareness to the problem. Some of the times the problems with awareness is everyone knows there's a problem, but they need to also know there's a solution. And so at Mighty Oaks, one of the things we focus on is being the solution. And we believe we found the cure to these things. And that's through making this man or woman making a simple decision to align their lives with the lives they were created to live. I mean, the process that you know, Steve Toth, when Kathy talked about introduced me to Steve Toth, introduced me to was the calibration of my life to the life I was intended to live, the life God created me to live. And that's the cure that we've discovered through Mighty Oaks for those who are struggling with post-traumatic stress. It's the peace that we believe builds more resilient people through spiritual resiliency. And so my hope and prayer is that we will eradicate veteran suicide. We will save lives and restore families and change legacies, not just for people's lives, but for eternity. Through introducing people to that cure, and the cure, simply put, is, you know, found through a relationship with Christ and being the people that God created us to be. The way we do that is through a very intensive peer-to-peer mentorship model by taking people who have been through that program, found that truth, found restoration, found hope, found new purpose again, and then didn't just find themselves in a position to be better for themselves, but to turn around and pay that forward to the next person. And that's where we have this peer-to-peer model that's just very successful because people listen to someone who's been where they've been and found hope and found restoration. And it also brings value to that person who's giving it back to know that they can share it with others. And in fact, the Bible commands us to do this when Jesus said to go forth and make disciples of others. This is something we're supposed to do as Christians. And so that's at the very DNA of what we do at Mighty Oaks and has been really the kind of matrix of success has been this peer-to-peer discipleship program.
Now, two-part question. If one is not religious or has a different, comes from a different religious background, mm-hmm. are they still welcome at Mighty Oaks? And what makes a great candidate for Mighty Oaks?
Our program, when we have the guys get there on Sunday or Monday when they show up, we would have about 50% of the people say they're Christians, and the other half of the people would identify as either atheist, agnostic, or they may just say they hate God and don't want anything to do with God. Well, what are you even doing here? Well, their parent made them come, their wife made them come, or their command sent them as some kind of ultimatum, or they're going, they're like, I'll just come in because this worked for my buddy, and if it worked for him, then I'll just leave the religious part out of it, and they'll call it a religious part. I'll leave that out of it, and I'll just get what I can get out of it. So most of the people, or at least half of the people that come to Mighty Oaks, do not come because it's a Christian program, and in fact, that's probably the furthest thing from their interest. Yeah, but they come because it's worked, and we've had a history of success. We've had 2,350 alumni, and we've had a tremendous amount of success with that. And so they come despite us being a faith-based program, and most of the time they leave with their relationship with God at the end of it. I want to say most of the time when we'd have 50% of the people that show up saying they don't believe in God, well, about 90% of the people leave there in a relationship with God. From an evangelical standpoint, I'm pretty happy about that, although it's not our goal. If we made evangelism the goal of our program, I don't think we'd have this. It's the goal of my life, but as far as the goal of the program, it's not the goal of the program. The goal of the program is to give them tools that we know and a model and a methodology we know will help them get past the hardships that they've endured and move into the future that they're going to find hope and purpose. The only way we know how to do that in a way that works is through introducing them to the model they were created to live and contrast their life to it and challenging them to live their life that way. The effects of that, the secondary effects of that, oftentimes is a relationship with God. So the ideal candidate for Mighty Oaks is we don't discriminate from anyone coming. So when I say that, a lot of programs will say, ask for certain criteria. You have to have served in combat. You have to have an honorable discharge. For us, anyone that's raised their hand and sworn an oath to protect and defend this nation is the qualification for us. So if someone's got kicked out of the military and has a bad conduct discharge, they could come. There's a very good chance that them getting kicked out of military may have to do with their experiences in the military. And so we don't want to disqualify them. We had someone at the last session with an ankle bracelet on. He actually got baptized. We had to hold his leg out of the water so we could electrocute it.
Wow.
But we're there to reach the broken and lost and the hurting and those who want to get back to living again and be productive again in our nation and in their communities. And so we don't want to disqualify folks from doing that. And as far as their faith and if they're, we've had Buddhists, atheists, we've had, you name it, have come to the program, Wiccan people. Those are who we want to reach. We want to reach the lost. So we don't put those stipulations. If someone served in the military, they qualify. I think people from all areas of life, from those who are just maybe struggling to reintegrate in civilian life to those who are in a catastrophic failure because of post-traumatic stress, those who are facing divorce, whatever they're facing, we believe the program is going to benefit them and help them move forward in life. And also, even though we're a veteran-focused program for active-duty veterans and spouses, we do serve first responders. The problems are equal. And, I mean, I think there was just a report came out that more first responders last year took their life than that died in the line of duty. So we serve first responders. Every session we'll have, like, two or three first responders, and in one of our 30 sessions that we have a year, we do it just completely 100% first responders. And we do it, everything for our veterans is free. Spouses, active duty, all that's free for them. We even pay for travel. We do the same for first responders as well.
Oh, that's awesome. So how can listeners get a hold of you if they're interested and want to learn more about the foundation and the program?
Well, our website is a pretty comprehensive website. It has all information. In fact, we're actually even updating our website next month. We'll have a brand new one. But even as now, they have a lot of information on it. The application is right at the top of the screen. You can click apply, and the application should only take the average person about 5 minutes to fill out. It's not very complicated. And within 3 days, someone from our organization will contact you back by email, set up a phone call, and we have 30 dates a year to get into the program. And so they'll work on the best date and location and then assign the appropriate team and team leader for that individual and get them slotted for a program. And so again, they're 1 week long. The sessions are 1 week long. We do 30 of them a year at 4 different locations around the country, 4 of our ranches. And the ranches are absolutely beautiful. Best example I'll give you is the one in California, closest to you, 25,000 acres. in San Luis Obispo County, beautiful Central Coast, California, and you know, amazing food, amazing amenities, and just a lot of fun, but also
a lot of work.
They're going to be really challenged and pushed to move forward in life.
So, Chad, do you have any closing thoughts or anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to speak to?
No, I just one of the things I just like to really emphasize on is any veterans listening and has questions, you know, reach out. The program is, there's no strings attached. The program is absolutely free. We pay for everything. We even pay for travel, and it's, you know, not that it's free. It's paid for on behalf of a grateful nation of people who support Mighty Oaks. And so if you don't fall in the area of people that need help and people that want to help, then we certainly, as a nonprofit, are looking for support to help make this possible to as many warriors as possible. And they could definitely get on the website and contribute into the cause by donating or supporting in other ways to Mighty Oaks.
And how about you, Kathy?
Yeah, actually, I was thinking about the women's program side of things. So though the men have many programs throughout the year, we will have four women's programs in 2019. And those women's programs will consist of both spouses and military females themselves, whether they're veterans or active duty. So we do serve the women as well. And a lot of times wives will come and they're searching for or they're wanting to find out how they can help their husband or how they can deal with their husband who has post-traumatic stress. I believe there's great programs for that out there that do educate spouses on that. But for us, it goes back to what Chad was saying, is just giving them the tools to line their life up with the life God created them to have. See, for me, it wasn't until my eyes were open to how I was acting, to what I was and was not doing in the relationship. And once I was able to recognize that, then we were able to move forward. Not that that gave him, I'm not giving him an excuse or a reason out, but it was kind of turning the mirror on you, looking at yourself in the mirror and recognizing things that you can improve on in your life. And that was where I found a turn in our relationship and our marriage. So that's one thing I like to share in as far as the women's program.
Very cool. Thank you very much. And I will post a link to the Mighty Oaks website for anybody who is interested in finding out more to go there. And also to anybody who wants to donate, because it really is an amazing program. It's helped so many people. And I wish you guys the best in the future and hopefully to see it expand and grow.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for having us on.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And just to communicate our story and the story of Christ in our life and then the story of Mighty Oaks, we just pray it just reaches so many more people.
Well, and thank you for coming on and being so open and really sharing your story. I know it's difficult, and but I think more people hear your story, can identify with even bits and pieces of it, and it's going to help somebody. So thank you for coming on. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen today. And I hope that you found something that really resonates with you. I can't wait to share even more. So please subscribe to the podcast, and you can find links to our resources in the description and at youroxygenmaskfirst.com.